Good afternoon and welcome to Dialect Radio for the week beginning Sunday, the 31st of October. I'm John Peters Coleman, and coming up this week, we'll be finding out what happened when the British National Party tried to set up their national media office in nearby Stroud, using a front name. As Bristol City Football Club suffer the bad karma that comes with dodgy property deals, we talk to Bristol's other football team, the Eastern Cowboys. I chat to Chaz and Adam. And we hear about Bristol from time to time, courtesy of Julian Lee Jones, and this week will be no exception. We'll be hearing more about the city's history. So we start this week in Stroud, and here's Dialect's Tony Gosling talking to the editor of Stroud News and Journal, Sue Smith, about the recent attempt by the BNP to set up their media headquarters there.
Sue Smith, I'm the editor of the Stroud News and Journal, which is the weekly newspaper in Stroud.
Now, we hear recently that the British National Party is considering moving to Stroud with its media operation.
The idea was that it would open up its media operation in Salmon Springs in Stroud. Apparently, it did take on the lease of the property March last year, and although it didn't identify itself to the owner, it organised the tenancy through a front tenancy. But details did emerge just a little while ago. I think it was around September, mid-September, that this was who it was and what the nature of the business down there was going to be. So we ran a few stories in our paper and got quite a considerable response from our readers and the community in general. The latest is that there was a big meeting organised by protesters against this, and on the very day of the meeting, a statement was issued by the BNP to say that they had scrapped their plans to come to Stroud, although the general view of the meeting, which did go ahead anyway, was that perhaps rather than it being a triumph, it might just take it as a few warning bells. I'm not sure we're all convinced that perhaps they might not try to open somewhere else within the area, but for now, the proposed site at Salmon Springs is not going ahead. That's what we've been told, and a statement issued by Nick Griffin.
I can't think of anywhere in the country which is least likely a place for the British National Party to feel is the home for their media operation, as Stroud is sort of generally quite left-wing, community-minded, certainly not in any way racist. So have you had any inkling as to why the BNP chose Stroud?
Absolutely not. You could say, why not Stroud? Because we do have, like every other community, we have BNP activists and supporters in our area, although possibly not as many as many other places for all the reasons that you said. It does seem an unlikely place because while we accept the BNP's got a legal right to be a political party, just like everybody else, because its principles are so firmly based on racism and fear and hate, it doesn't really sit comfortably in a place like Stroud, which is historically known for being welcoming, accepting, just an open community, really, that takes all nationalities and sexual orientation and colours and creeds. It wouldn't be the top of the list, I wouldn't have thought, when they were looking for a place to open up. So it is quite baffling. I imagine there probably are places that it might not have received such opposition. So it is baffling, yeah.
The BNP, as you say, is actually a political party, and in a democracy, they would say themselves, for example, that they aren't racist.
They do say that, yes. But I think it's generally known that they do hold many views that today, in modern society and in the world in which we live, that the vast majority of people find those views quite distasteful and inappropriate, and never more so than Stroud, which is just known for its liberalism and openness. So I think that's why there was so much opposition to it. It just wasn't welcome at all. And Stroud is a very vocal community. People are well known for standing up for what they want and what they don't want, and they make themselves heard when they don't want something, and on this occasion they shouted quite loudly and made it quite an unattractive proposition for them.
Thank you very much to Sue Smith there, who is the editor of Stroud News and Journal, speaking to our very own Tony Gosling. Bristol has one of the richest heritages of local history of any city in Europe, and in 1980s, the Temple Local History Group began. Engineer, historian and author Julian Lee Jones was one of the founders, and he's the author of a book called Bristol Curiosities. Evidently, eagle-eared listeners will remember previous episodes of this, and here is another one. Dialect's Tony Gosling finishes his conversations this week with Julian about Bristol's hidden history, and to wind up, Julian talks about something which was unique to Bristol until the coming of the railways, Bristol time, and gives us a status report on some of Bristol's historic timepieces.
So this is Langford's electric clock. What period does it date from?
Again, this is a result of being curious and putting your nose in where, it wasn't wanted, and it was made work for ourselves. What happened, walking up past College Green on what is the music shop, there's a clock overhanging the pavement, and it says Langford's Electric on it, and it's not working. Sadly, it's not working again now today. But at that time, in the 1980s, 1984, something like that, it wasn't working. We inquired of the then owner of the music shop, Tony Alcock. It's a city leased property. He said, oh, it's one of these clocks where the movement isn't in the clock face at all. That's just a dial. If you look closely, you'll see a thin shaft running from the clock. And quite often this applies to bracket clocks over pavements on sort of upper stories of buildings. There's a shaft that runs all the way down through the building, and the actual clock movement is in the basement, in a cupboard. Langford's, because Langford's, the clocksmith and the Goldsmiths Alliance, used to be in the premises there at College Green. And they were very famous Bristol clockmakers. They specialised in tower clocks, and they were also silversmiths, jewellers, hence the Goldsmiths Alliance part of it. This goes back to the 1850s. What happened was that prior to the sort of 1850s, in 1840, 1841, when the railway came to Bristol, prior to that time, all towns around the country operated on local time, solar time, sidereal time, and it didn't really matter. Now, Bristol is 10 minutes, nearly 11 minutes west of London. But so what? I mean, if it took a day or so to get from London to Bristol, it didn't matter a hoot. But when you've got a train that will arrive, I think actually arrive to Bristol faster than it does now, but never mind. We suddenly realised that you needed to have some form of synchronised time. But London still operated on Greenwich Mean Time, and Bristol operated on Bristol time. When the railways arrived in Bristol, there is one famous story about how on one of the first trains that arrived, the train was running on railway time, as it was then known, and the good citizens of Bristol, the dignitaries, arrived at Temple Meads, Brunel's spanking new station, to welcome the train, to find it had arrived 10 minutes before, or 11 minutes before. Now, I think that would probably come within their 98% timekeeping criteria, wouldn't it, anyway? But anyway, the outcome was that it was the merchants realised that in the absence of adopting London time, the main clock on the exchange, the merchants' exchange in Bristol, which we generally refer to as the Corn Exchange, which isn't strictly correct, the clock on there, so what they did, they put 2 minute hands on it. Mr. Langford, who was goldsmith and clockmaker, he saw an opportunity here. And what he did, you could buy, because with the when the telegraph came to Bristol, there was an office in the commercial rooms in Corn Street, a telegraph office, that sent a time signal through every day, 1 o'clock. It's just a little telegraph, bip, and that was it. And he bought from the post office, the railway sold it to the post office, the time signal, or the facility. And he bought it, and then took it to his premises, which were then down on Broad Quay. There were a firm making what they call slave clocks and master clocks. In other words, basically, it was a clock that could send an impulse to other slave clocks. And Mr. Langford provided 19 of the main establishments, Wills Tobacco, the Tramways Company and various other, Chamberlain Pole, the corn merchants and various other people, and the cathedral. He provided them with slave clocks, and then he had a master clock in his premises. And it was done on a simple process that at the given time, different towns had a time signal sent to them at different times of the day. So it controlled his clock, and they would just count down, so they knew it was within a few sort of seconds, and he would count down with a stopwatch right in the pit window, and they'd just adjust their clock, which then sent an accurate GMT, a London time, railway time, out to all of his customer establishments. And this clock was his first one, that was his advert. When there was the Bristol Industrial Exhibition down on the centre, he had used an electric clock there as a big, it was a huge one, you can see it on, if you look at in the Reese Winston books, with the pictures of the exhibition building, which is sort of built by Colston's statue across there, and you see a huge great big dial on there. The Tramways clock, of course, the famous one on the centre, that was controlled by his signal. And I reckon that I think it was 49 million minutes he sold of time before technology and the war and bombing of the lines overtook it. But we asked Tony Alcock, and he said, well, he didn't know. So we then spoke to the city, the landlords, and they said, well, it was the responsibility of, oh, we didn't realise it wasn't working, because, of course, they're so far away in the council house, aren't they? They said it was his responsibility, and I mean, to get something like this restored. So we said, we'll help. We'll organise an appeal. And Tony paid. So what we did, we researched the history pretty much as I've just been saying. One of our members, we recorded and did, Roger Blake did the illustrations of the clock that's down in the basement. And another one of our members, Nick Cox, did some rather superb illustration of the clock itself. And Tony Alcock paid for a glossy A4 commemorative leaflet, and we sold the leaflets, and we must have sold nearly 1,000 of these, and that raised enough money to pay for the restoration of the clock. And Alec French and Partners donated a clock which they'd got from another premises that they were controlling, that they'd bought down in Silver Street. Anyway, we got it all together, and we had a sort of grand opening, and next thing I knew with this was that the horological sort of magazines in London, they got involved, and next thing I found, I was doing a lecture on it to the Horological Society in Kensington Science Museum, which was a bit nerve-wracking, because my knowledge of clocks was fairly from an engineering viewpoint.
Now, you mentioned the famous tramway clock. Whereabouts is that?
Tramway clock is the big square one with the blue face with Roman numerals, actually on, well, it used to be the tramways office. It's the one with the mock Dutch gable end, actually on the centre, just before you turn around to go up the corner to the Colston Hall, the one that hangs out, big square box hanging out over the pavement. Most of them, that one and most of the others now, are electrically, locally controlled and electric driven. One last anecdote with those is that another one of the clocks that was controlled by electricity prior to the damage during the last war was the St. Nicholas clock on the tower of the church. It was designed by Edwin Langford, and it has a sweep second hand, because he said he thought that it's only one in Britain with a sweep second hand. And he said his watch had a sweep second hand, so he didn't see why a church clock. But it was bombed and destroyed and replaced by a standard electric synchronous movement after the war. And one of the problems, if you can remember, people can remember from early electric clocks, if you switch them off, when you switch them back on, it would sometimes run backwards, and you had to flick it to make it run in the right direction, because there was no symmetry in the winding. And one incident, I was waiting, when we were working at Sperry, and I was waiting for the bus stop outside the DRG building, that very drafty bus stop on Victoria Street, and I looked up, and it was nearly 7 o'clock, waiting for the bus there in the cold and winter evening. And then when I looked a little later, it was 10 to 7. And because what had happened, there'd been a power cut, and the clock was running backwards. I mean, they had a happy ending, actually, because I was able to catch the previous bus.
Just finally then, on Langford's clock, is when you managed to restore it, was all the gubbins, the actual machinery for the clock, still in the basement and of the music shop then?
Yes, and it is, as far as I'm aware, it is still there. But what happened, the premises behind the clock, above the music shop, somebody damaged the shaft and it's never been repaired. And if you have a look in the window of the music shop, you'll find that there's a pipe running down through the main window, the display window, and what you'll find is that the shaft runs in there, and I think it's been damaged somewhere, and nobody appears to have the impetus and initiative to actually get and restore it. But it's rather sad. But one of the things we did do finally on that was that when it was the anniversary of GMT, we actually persuaded the city. We had a plate, a brass plate, inset in the pavement to draw people's attention to the fact that the line directly underneath that clock, it's 2 degrees, 35 minutes and 47 seconds west of the GMT. And it was in 1852 that Mr. Langford's electric clock took its time by telegraph from Greenwich Royal Observatory.
Julian Lee James there in the final part of his talks about local history, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling. And thank you very much to him for his time. You'll find Julian's Temple Local History Group website at, pens at the ready, www.history4u.info. History for you is history, the number 4, and the letter U. Historyforyou.info. It's my pleasure to introduce a new rock promotion or a sort of music promotion duo that I've got in the studio. For the moment, they've called themselves Mongrels of Rock Promotions, and they're going to try and put on some nights. Rowena Hicks and Jamie Plumley, hello.
Well, hiya.
Hiya.
So is this a new venture for you? Are you new to this kind of thing? Or?
It is. Well, how it all started out was I met Jamie a few months ago, and I do a lot of charity work for a charity called Dogs Friends, a very local-based charity that helps save dogs, basically. And I told Jamie all about how much in debt they were and how much we needed some funds. So we got together and decided to put on our Mongrels of Rock gig, hence the name that went on 26th of August, wasn't it?
26th of August, yeah. And all this pretty much started up around April time, so it was done in a short space of time.
Okay. When you came in earlier on, you came in with a huge crowd of other blokes. So I opened the door expecting one person, and there was a whole crowd, and you've got another band out there called The Hookers. So are you sort of helping promote this band? Is that how it works?
That's right, yeah. We met them probably about a couple of weeks beforehand, didn't we?
It was very, very short notice for them to play for us. The gig was actually 3 weeks away.
Where did the gig take place?
It was a Tunnels by Templemead Station. Okay. Yeah, we managed to blag that didn't we?
A prestige venue, I've got to say.
Yes, prestige.
So as a first night, did you actually manage to make any money? A lot of it's quite easy to lose money.
We made probably about between £700 and £800 that night, all for the charity.
It was all very, very successful, and every penny went to the charity itself.
Yeah.
We're planning to bring it back this year with Mongrels 2011. It's going to be bigger, better and brasher than last year.
October 2011, we're hoping for, 2 days.
We're looking at 2-dater this year. We're in consideration of whether we're going to do it every 6 months or just do a warm up and a headline. So a warm up on the night, obviously the night before the bands that's due to play, just to get the nitty gritties going, and the headliner something big, brash and kind of unusual. This year we had Velvet Revolvers, and it's the first ever Velvet Revolvers UK based tribute, and it went down a right storm.
Yeah, and we also had Black Wolf, who regularly play in Bristol. They're a local Bristol band, and we also had Dirty Break as well.
I mean,
I'm assuming you also try and get a lot of support on Facebook and MySpace, seeing as that is the de rigueur thing to do these days. How successful do you actually find that in getting people to your gig?
Very successful. But the thing is, as well, is we've played it really clever this year with the marketing side of things. Because we haven't had a budget for this year, we've not just done MySpace and Facebook, we've also used Gumtree as well for the free advertising, which is what got a lot kind of a few of our bands.
Yeah, and we've done a lot of flyering as well, which funnily enough is how we met the Hookers. Because, we were there promoting Black Wolf, weren't we, in the Mongrels of Rock gig. And I went up to them saying, do you like the band here tonight? Would you like to come to another of their gig? And they're like, oh, we are the band. So it all started off like that.
Right, okay. Yeah. And what other bands around Bristol have you got involved as well?
Well, at present we've got Dirty Break and we've got Black Wolf on our books.
Who are brilliant. Both of them are brilliant.
Both of them are absolutely amazing. Mm. We are actually having other bands come to us as well. We've got like a band called Rough Cut that's shining interest in us. There's a few other names right now in the bag, but we don't want to say too much because obviously we've got Mongrels 2011 coming up. We want to kind of make it a bit of a surprise, really. So
Yeah, okay. Yeah, but I mean, if there's anyone out there listening who's in a band, any sort of band, we're not just looking for rock bands, but folk bands, whatever, like, get in touch if you want to, like, help us out.
There is going to be more than one festival through our promotions company once we're officially settled down.
Yeah.
At the moment, with the success of Mongrels of Rock for this coming year now, we kind of really want to get a few things going.
Okay, and it's sort of rock and roll, heavy rock, punk.
Yeah, well, we're looking at rock, folk, we're kind of looking at all genres, really. I mean, at the end of the day, it's like, you know, you can't just sort of cut everybody out of this. We kind of want to...
Yeah, and we've got a punk fest in the pipeline, haven't we? We've got a lineup for that, but we can't reveal who that is.
No.
Right. Not yet.
So let's just recruit. Which charity is it for again?
It's for Dogs Friends.
Dogs Friends, yeah. Okay, yeah. And presumably if you just put Dogs Friends in a search engine or whatever, that'll bring them up pretty quick. Do you know the web address?
Oh, it will, yeah. www.dogsfriends.co.uk. Very little charity. Basically, they do take on the dregs of the Dog World Society that lots of big charities would put down. So that's probably why they're so much in debt. They take dogs from, like, breeding farmers and lots from pounds. It's just terrible, some of the states that they're in. But
and search for Mongrels of Rock. That's what the name you're running with at the moment. Is that how people can find you on Facebook and MySpace?
Yeah, we're on Facebook.
Yeah, we're on Facebook. I mean, we are looking to get domain names sorted out as soon as possible. This isn't just a five-minute idea and that's it. It's like we're going to make this long-term. We are actually... in our heads, planning to take on the next Ashton Court, really. It sounds
fingers crossed, you never know.
You know, so if
you've got to have a vision.
Yeah,
absolutely, man. Go on. Thanks very much.
If there's somebody out in the council out there that like to kind of give us a hand on how we get there, then...
Well, thank you very much for coming in. Ruin Hicks, Jamie Plumley, I thank you very much and wish you best of luck. Thank you.
No worries. Thanks very much.
Okay, well, I'll give you some contact details as well as the Mongrels of Rock name after I've interviewed a couple of the Hookers. Let's hear a bit of their music first. This is Dark Grip by the Hookers. Well, that was Dark Grip, and I've got the singer Dan and Jimmy, the lead guitarist. Hello.
Hi.
So, how old is Hookers? How long has this been going concern?
We've been going for about a year and a half now. We were in a band before, but we had so many lineup changes, and Dan's been in the band now for a year and a half, and we've just been gigging away, just finally got some recording done recently and we're back in the studio next month. So,
cool. So you think the lineup's stabilised and now you confidently got,
definitely.
Got a solid unit?
Yeah, we seem to be a lot more stable now, you know, having a proper good time together, and we seem to be bonding really well as a band.
Cool. How many of you are there?
Currently, we're working between 5 and 4 people, just sort of getting to grips with our rhythm guitarist at the moment, and you know, working between lineups and that. But we've definitely got the solid 4 piece of obviously vocals, guitar, bass, and drums, and you know, yeah. It's a solid family.
So, how did you go about starting up a band in the first place? You sort of like advertise, or is it friends of friends, or did it all sort of fall into place? Or
well, I was playing guitar for years and. Was just sick of playing in my bedroom, to be honest.
Yeah.
And, it was hard. Like, first I started playing acoustic stuff just to actually be able to play in front of an audience, and eventually we found the musicians, because drummers are pretty hard to come by. And like,
yeah. Decent drummers, I mean, we've had a few.
I originally started singing purely because we couldn't find a singer, and then someone started coming along to our gigs all the time and he sang, and then he took over.
Where do you practice at the moment?
In Weston. Okay. We actually come from Clevedon, but we...
Yeah, we've got a nice little sort of studio set up. We've been for a couple of different places, but we found a place that's really working for us at the moment. So
some people find sort of trying to promote themselves online to be an awful lot of effort and not a lot of return. How have you found it?
I actually think it's pretty easy, but yeah, not a lot of return. I think the best way to promote yourself is getting out there. Since we've recorded, every gig we go to with like 20, 30 CDs and just give them away. There's no point in asking people for money for them.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day...
We're not trying to sell albums at this stage. We're just like, everyone listen to our band.
Yeah.
Hopefully you'll think we're good, come see us, and then we can sort of develop a bigger fan base and that, and... Yeah, hopefully people will like what we do and, you know, we can start to get somewhere with this.
So what sort of Bristol bands do you play with, and how do you find the rock scene in Bristol at the moment?
Well, for our style of music, which is hard rock, there's not that many out there. I mean, there's a lot of people jumping on the bandwagon these days and just playing along same old indie music, which I'm not really into, but...
It's not good enough, like...
Yeah, what's your main influence then, you say?
Black Sabbath, Guns N' Roses...
And one of our sort of main influences is definitely the Pistols, because they got a bit of that attitude, you know, sort of trying to develop a band persona as well as being music. We want to have a bit of a personality as a band. And
have you been approached by any Svengalis looking to snap you up and be your manager?
We've been approached a couple of times recently. It's, you know, it's great because we've been putting in the effort. It's great when people start to sort of you start to get a bit of sought after, rather than, yeah, we'll play this gig, we'll do anything, just let us play, let us hear us. From it turns around to people wanting to sort of hear us, and you know, it's great to sort of start getting somewhere. We've just got sort of our new, we teamed up with Rowena and Jamie and sort of trying to start push it forward that way. Yeah.
Okay, so how have you found sort of working with them? How did being approached by them and doing some
charity? We done a gig last minute, and basically Rowena came to the gig and she said that we were really good and everything like that. I didn't have my mobile phone on me, so she wrote her number on my chest.
Yeah, very rough.
And,
like that.
One of the numbers smudged in the morning. I had to phone 4 other different people.
You had to phone me up, didn't you? Because the different part was smudged on my chest, so we just worked it out together.
Are you getting signed to a label, or are you looking to do anything?
Well,
like
that's
that?
That's obviously that's the ultimate goal, but...
Yeah, looking to get signed and...
I think it's sort of picky and choosy. You don't want to just jump into something like that.
Okay. Where can people find you? I've got a MySpace, actually, if I look. There you go. MySpace.com, The Hookers UK. And we can also find you on Facebook, I understand. You've got a couple of gigs in November. Tell us about those.
The first gig we've got in November is actually the 2nd of November. It's The Fleece. And it's the first time we've actually played The Fleece with our new lineup. So really looking forward to it. And, get there if you can, guys, because good night of proper rock and roll.
Yeah.
And, The Croft is one we're actually putting on ourselves. We've hired out, and it's a ticketed event, so if anyone wants tickets, just contact us at MySpace.
We're on Facebook as well.
Okay.
All right. Well, The Hookers.
Well, thank you very much for coming in, and let's hear a track now, The Weeknds, and get your pen and paper ready for contact details if you want to contact Mongrels of Rock Promotions. That was The Weekends by The Hookers. Thank you very much to Dan and Jimmy for coming in. Now, Mongrels of Rock Promotions, whom they're also helping, if you want to get in contact with Rowena Hicks as part of that, her phone number is 07900 812 078. Alternatively, you can always email Jamie, blackjp2@hotmail.co.uk. I'll say that again, blackjp2@hotmail.co.uk. And we wish them the very best of luck. Dogs Friends Charity.
Thanks
as well.
Ever so much for having us.
Yeah, and no worries. Dan and Jimmy, thank you very much. Well, it's my pleasure to introduce Chaz and Adam. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
So, would one of you lads like to tell us a little bit about how the Eastern Cowboys Sports and Social Club started?
Shall I do that? Okay. We've been around for about 20 years. As originally started with a men's football team, one men's football team. I think it was formed by a load of sort of punks who were interested in forming their own club for people like themselves. And I think they joined the league in Bristol, and over the last 20 years it's expanded massively to include men's football teams. I think there's five.
Seven, I think.
Seven now, is there?
Oh, there might be two women's, sorry.
Yeah, we've got women's football teams as well, three men's cricket teams, two netball teams, two women's netball teams, and a mixed basketball team.
Okay.
So we've got five sports, basically.
And there's various football teams under the banner of the Eastern Cowboys or in an informal league that compete against each other, is that right?
Not exactly.
No? Not in the same league, no. It's split out over several different leagues. I play in the Downs League on Saturday afternoons. There's two football teams in the two different Downs Leagues. There's a football team in the Suburban, Bristol Suburban League.
And there's a Sunday team, Saturday team.
Sunday team.
And there's two casuals teams as well for the us older people, for the over 35s.
Okay, and that's based all over Bristol City, where obviously Eastern Cowboys implicates that, but it's sort of city-wide now, is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the club's based in Eastern, in on the east side of Bristol. But we do, you know, we accept members from all round, so...
Okay. Well, what do you do? Because you've just been on a tour of Palestine. How does a sports and social club wind up going on a tour of Palestine?
After you, Chester.
Okay, well, this is our second tour of Palestine this year. We went in May this year. We first went 3 years ago, and Eastern Cowboys is almost like an alternative grassroots sports and social club. Eastern Cowboys and Eastern Cowgirls, I should say. And we've got sister clubs all around the country and all around Europe, and we do tournaments together. And one of our sister clubs is Republica from Leeds, and they had some contacts out in Hebron, in Palestine, in the West Bank.
Right.
And the Republica team, they wanted to set up a tour, but they couldn't get enough people interested. So they basically, I think they asked us to get involved about 4 years ago, and then we kind of took over because there was a lot of people interested in going out to Palestine 4 years ago. We did the tour back in 2007, and it was a great success. And so, you know, I don't know, maybe about a year ago, we put the feelers out to see who was interested in going again.
So there is quite a strong enough interest in sport in Palestine to merit sort of teams going over and sort of playing football.
Absolutely, yeah. Football is everything in Palestine. I don't know about the Middle East in general, but
right.
It's hugely popular. They know every single European player you can think of, every team, every league. They know everything, and very, very good.
That might be a quite surprise to people in Britain. So what sort of media channels do people in the West Bank have access to?
I have no idea, but they have satellite dishes, just like everywhere else does.
Yeah.
And,
Yeah,
for a young man in Palestine, it's life. It is full-on life.
Yeah, yeah, and they, you know, when we went out there, they thought we were professional footballers, and we're not, unfortunately.
Right.
And they were saying, you know, David Beckham, Ronaldo, they were just shouting out all Messi and all the names of the famous European footballers, and they are obsessed about football. They make us look like we're not interested.
Right, okay. I mean, does it frustrate you? Obviously, you're really keen on football. You just see people in gyms when, you know, they could be playing team sports. What really attracts you about team sports, specifically?
Well, for me, gyms are boring. I can be a solitary person, but if you've ever played football, if you find your level, it's fantastic. You can forget all your worries and have a real good laugh.
Mm.
A great exercise. Yeah, really confidence building. Team building is really a nice social event.
Yeah, there's a lot of social side to our club as well. And it's all about people getting involved and doing stuff together. And the Eastern Cowboys and Cowgirls is a community club. We do lots of political stuff as well, campaigning around the city and also around the world. One of the things is going to Palestine, but we've been to other tours all around the world as well. And we're also involved in anti-racist sports tournaments.
Okay.
It's all DIY, grassroots. We do it all ourselves.
So how many of you, and what sort of age range, wound up going to Palestine?
Very varied. I'm one of the younger, and I'm 27, and I guess the oldest was probably at least 20 years older than me.
Yeah, mid-50s.
No, Kaz is about 30 years older than me.
Sorry, Kaz.
So, a real good mix of age and background.
Yeah, there was about 15 of us, I think,
yeah,
in total.
Sure.
Okay. A couple of guys from Republica in Leeds came, and about, how many women did we have? Five?
Yeah, possibly in the end.
How did you get there?
Big bad aeroplane.
Yeah. Yeah, there's not much alternative unless you do overland. You fly into Tel Aviv.
Right.
To the international airport there, and then you go overland into the West Bank.
Okay.
So we were met by friends out there. We've got contacts out in Palestine, in the West Bank, and they run a charity that tries to help really disadvantaged communities in the West Bank, especially small villages who are surrounded by illegal Israeli settlements. So they don't have much infrastructure and they're quite poor. Some are living in tents and...
Mainly living in tents, yeah.
Yeah, like really very poor.
It's kind of going back hundreds of years in terms of technology, the people...
So what is it actually like when you enter the West Bank? What happens? I've sort of got an image of, like, you know, man to the teeth with security guards police.
We entered at night and the checkpoint wasn't manned at night. Mm. But, you know, there is a presence. There's a huge military presence everywhere you go.
Yeah, as internationals, it's quite different. You don't get stopped at checkpoints. So because they could see that we were white, the Israeli military didn't stop us. If you're a Palestinian, you get held up at checkpoints. This is daily. You get held up at checkpoints for hours. So their whole life on an everyday basis is completely disrupted and controlled by the Israeli military.
Well, I can obviously see that sport and football is going to be a welcome relief from politics, but I don't know, how does sport relate to politics for them? Do they take it quite politically?
How does sport relate to politics?
Are they quite political in their affiliations, do you think, or is it just an excuse to get away from politics completely?
Well, that's a good question, but I'd say in the big part, it's a massive chance. It's really, I think it's great for them to see that there was an outside interest, international interest, people sharing similar interests for a very, I don't know, people live very restricted lives out there. For a young male, it's very difficult movement to find work. Yeah, it's not particularly easy. So have a football team come in, share your interests. Yeah, it breaks barriers. It breaks down the language barrier, the religious barriers, the political barriers.
So tell me a little bit, you say it's difficult for a young man. I mean, you have mixed teams, men and women going out there. Was it the same Palestinians turning up? I mean, was it a mixture of male and female sort of Palestinians used? Was it quite unusual for them to be mixing?
Yeah, we were kind of given some background in etiquette before we went about when and where to sort of interact with females and stuff. Yeah. And I think it was quite novel for them to be able to interact with English women, say young women, unmarried women. It's a very different culture.
So what do you mean by etiquette? What sort of restrictions did you have to be aware of when you...
Well, it is a Muslim country, Palestine, and so you just have to respect people. And there wasn't supposed to be sort of mixing between one of us, like a white man, and a Palestinian lady in private. So it's totally fine to talk to them in public, but it's slightly different in private, so we'd obviously be aware of that side of things. Palestinians are very well educated, very advanced people. So many of them go to university, they're very intelligent, and they're very aware that our culture is different to theirs as well, and they were respecting our culture and realising that it's slightly different in England than what it is in Palestine.
So in between 2007 to 2010, what's the latest, do you think, in terms of how Palestine, well, in the West Bank specifically, where you went, has sort of progressed or not in the last 3 years?
Can I say a bit about what we saw? The things that we were faced with. A lot of the villages, we visited small villages that were they all talked about having land taken away from them by Israelis. They were all patrolled by Israeli military regularly. There's checkpoints, there's viewing towers. These people are cut off from their own land, so they struggle with access for water. They have to dig like rain capture wells and stuff. They don't have electricity, they're not allowed. This kind of situation where they can't even build schools, they can't build toilets, they can't build houses, because there's a banning on building in these areas, which is Israeli state laws, not Palestinian laws.
But that's within Palestine.
Sure,
itself.
This is within Palestine. So the kind of things we were confronted by was that, we were staying with people living in tents, we're getting water out of the ground from rain capture. They have real restricted access, they can't travel to neighbouring villages, places they could, say, a few months ago, because of Israeli checkpoints, because of the military. So, yeah, there's a real frustration out there. It wasn't, we didn't see bombs or fighting, that kind of thing, but it's very evident, heavy military presence. And
they were just so glad that we came out there and showed an interest in them, because they really feel neglected and totally isolated, because despite the fact that Israel has broken many United Nations resolutions and in breach of the Geneva Convention, the Palestinian people still feel that Israel is allowed to act with impunity. And so for us just to go there and show an interest, they just showed us such great hospitality. And we said, like, what can we do to help? And they said, well, when you go back home, tell people what is really going on and try and help us that way by spreading the word.
How can people get involved, you know, with the Eastern Cowboys if they want to?
That's easy. Come and join us. There's people want to join all sports. In fact, we're more than happy to even start new sports. I'd quite fancy getting a table.
How can people get in touch?
Google Eastern Cowboys. There's a dedicated website, really good website, with lots of photos and information about previous tours.
I'd also like to advertise, or perhaps you would, you're doing a talk about the tour. Tell us a little bit about that on the 3rd of November, I understand.
Yeah, Wednesday the 3rd of November, Eastern Community Centre from about 7:30. So it's Eastern Cowboys and the Eastern Cowgirls doing a talk and a slideshow about our latest tour, Solidarity Tour to Palestine.
About what we've been talking about tonight in a bit more detail.
Yeah, and hopefully some good photos to get people stimulated, and also help people how get more involved if they want to start campaigning on behalf of the Palestinian people.
Okay, and I suppose the final question's got to be is... who won more out of the football matches, you or the Palestinians?
Didn't get around to this, did we?
Do we have to answer that question?
Well, there you go, that answers the question.
We did win one match, right?
Yes.
But they're great, they're really good at football, and we did get beaten. But we played 9 matches in 8 days, so...
Okay.
We played a lot of football, but it was great, and the football was brilliant.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Chaz and Adam, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure to introduce Tim Burrows, our resident poet, to the studio. Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Excellent. What have you got for us today?
Well, I'm working on a project called Songs for the Earth Mother, which is a whole series of my poems around the way we seem to be destroying our beautiful planet. And over the years, I've written some, and I'm gradually putting them together. So I can do a couple of pieces that I'm putting in this collection I'm trying to put together.
Okay.
This one's called Seek Out the Sacred. Seek out the sacred. Chant it at daybreak, incant it at dusk. Give the day a framework, a history, a connection with the past, our ancestors. A glimpse through the gloom of shopping, of minuted time, of scientific documentation that drains the magic, leaving cold, measured matter. Seek out the sacred. Chant it at daybreak, incant it at dusk. Break the hold of stainless steel, of things cold, suffocated in plastic, counted, compiled, classified, life as butterfly, on pin, on board. Seek out the sacred, chant it at daybreak, incant it at dusk. Seek it at the edge of water, where the mist brings the spirits in.
Thank you, Tim. Is that all for just the one this week?
I've got one that follows in the same. This one I wrote quite a few years ago, and I kind of found it, and it shows that I've been working around this for quite a long time. Just open the bottom drawer. It's empty. Feel the hollow. The grain on its inner silence is whole. Hide in the corner of its rectangular form. Breathe in the varnish in the wood and sink into a wooded glade. Find the fallen leaves beneath your feet. Feel the loam between your toes. The pulse of the earth sighs at your touch. Feel one with the planet. Its oceans surge. Breathe deep. The linked reality of form. Learn to stand at one with the land.
How extraordinary. Thank you very much, Tim. Thank you. You've also got something to plug, if you so like that. You'll like this. An event called Strange Creatures of the Night. Tell us about this.
I have a great liking for serial art and the idea of imagination and kind of seeking art from the subconscious, which all happened after the Dada movement and then surrealism. So I've got together a bunch of mates, and we're doing an event on the 20th of November, Saturday, on the Under the Stars boat, which is just on the harbour opposite the watershed. Yep. We've got the up-and-coming wonderful Scarlet Rascal playing as the main band. Myself and Trevor Cart, who both do poetry here, doing some poetry. I'm doing a couple of songs. Elliot Hall's doing some songs. Rob Howard's doing some songs. And Chris Beckett's doing some songs. So if you like dressing up and you want a night of surreal entertainment, please come along.
Excellent. That's on Saturday the 20th of November, the Under the Stars Cafe Bar, which is the bar on the boat, which is opposite the falafel van, on the other side of the dock from the watershed. Got down here, the time is 9 p.m. till 2 a.m. So we'll be surrealising it up until the early hours. £5 on the door, £4 in advance. Where can people get a ticket in advance?
Best goes to the venue or ask if you know any of us, the artists, but that's the best. Or just turn up on the night.
Okay.
It's going to be £5 on the door, £4 in advance. I think that one, that's best, yeah.
Okay, and it says, be Salvador Dali or Mae West or a walking fantasy. So get your glab rags on, dress up and go along to that. Tim Burrows, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
The man who sits as still as a rock, he will not be moved, and he's also wearing a Sepultura t-shirt this week. Who can this be? Jeff Sparks with this week's What's On Guide.
Thank you, John. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off with Friday, 5th of November, 999 will be performing with support from the Pigs and also the Lone Sharks at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. On Saturday, 6th of November, Left Side Brain will be celebrating their 10th anniversary with support from Cars on Fire, Dutch Schultz, Freezy Atlantic, GU Medicine and also Oxygen Thief at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance, with all proceeds going to Cancer Research UK and also Motor Neuron Disease Association. On to Song of the Week and our feature Goober Gun. This group formed in 2002, and in their history have gone through a couple of name changes and also lineup changes. This is from their latest three-track CD titled 1979, and there's a song called Going Home. Taking a while. That was Goober Gun with Going Home from the three-track CD titled 1979. This group are relocating to Asia for the foreseeable future, so all the best to them. For more information, you can check out myspace.com/Goober Gun. Finally, on Sunday, 7th of November, Nouvelle Vague will be performing at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £17.50 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Well, that's all for this week. Time's up already. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers, no less, and broadcast on Bristol Community FM at 12 noon every Sunday, 93.2. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday evening when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, which is dialectradio.co.uk. You can find a lo-fi mono version of Dialect for dial-up connections at bristol.indiemedia.org every Friday morning. Indie Media is indie with a Y. So thank you all to our studio guests, Chaz and Adam from the Eastern Cowboys, Rowena and Jamie of Muggles of Rock, and we also had the Hookers on. Thank you also to Tim Burrows for his poem, and the reporters this week were Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Studio production was by Michael Noyes, the assistant producer was Michaela Dennis, and the producer was Tony Gosling. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. So if you'd like to, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. Also, you can find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Next week, our sometime engineer Lee Duffield is producing the programme, and we'll have some guests on discussing animal rights. So I've been John Peters Cohen, and I wish you a very good week. Goodbye.
Same old song. I know every crack in these dirty sidewalks of Broadway, where hustle's the name of the game, and nice guys get washed away like the snow and the rain. There's been a load of compromising on the road. But I'm gonna be where the lights are shining on me, like a rhinestone cowboy, riding out on a horse in a star-spangled rodeo, like a rhinestone cowboy, getting caught. Coming over the phone. Well, I really don't mind the rain, and a smile can hide all the pain, but you're down when you're riding the train that's taking the long way. And I dream of the things I'll do with a subway token and a dollar tucked inside my shoe. There'll be a load.